Think about the terms of service for being an American. We all, you know, kind of just click agree without really reading it.
Right. Nobody ever reads the fine print.
Exactly. But the 14th Amendment has this famous 14-word citizenship clause. And the main rule seems incredibly straightforward. I mean, if you were born here, you're a citizen.
Yeah, that is the general understanding.
But welcome to today's deep dive into the source material. We've got this really comprehensive legislative report on birthright citizenship. And just to be clear up front, our mission here is to objectively weigh the historical, legal, and socioeconomic arguments laid out in this document.
Right. And these arguments come from all over the political spectrum. So we are not taking a side or endorsing anything here.
No, not at all. We are just impartially reporting on the ideas in the text. Because this massive 150-year-old debate hinges on this tiny bit of fine print in that agreement. The phrase, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
Yeah, that fine print is doing a lot of heavy lifting. I mean, to really understand why it's so contested today, we have to look at why the 39th Congress wrote it in the first place.
Right, after the Civil War.
Exactly. They needed to explicitly overturn the Dred Scott decision. That was the case that infamously declared Black Americans could not be citizens. So by establishing just solely the right of the soil, they created a strict geographic rule.
To make sure former slaves were unquestionably citizens just by being born here.
You got it.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if the framers just intended a simple geographic rule, how do the consensualists challenge that today?
Well, consensualists argue that citizenship shouldn't just be an accident of geography. They believe it requires mutual consent between the individual and the state.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning that unauthorized or temporary residents still owe their primary allegiance to a foreign power. So under this view, their children aren't completely subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. because they lack that full political bond.
But wait, did jurisdiction actually require political allegiance? Because, I mean, if I'm a tourist and I run a red light in Chicago, I am definitely subject to the jurisdiction of the local courts, right?
Right.
Regardless of my allegiance.
Sure, you have to follow local laws.
Right. But the text brings up the 1884 Elkie Wilkins case. A Native American man born within U.S. borders was denied citizenship. Specifically because he owed allegiance to his tribe. So does that prove the framers actually did think jurisdiction meant more than just physically being here?
Yeah, that is exactly the historical precedent critics of universal birthright citizenship lean on. They argue that if tribal allegiance historically excluded you, a parent's foreign allegiance should exclude you today.
Oh, wow.
But defenders of the current system counter this. They point out the 14th Amendment was designed to be explicitly inclusive to prevent a hereditary underclass.
Yeah, moving from constitutional theory to the actual logistics. Though implementing a consent-based system would fundamentally change how every single person proves who they are.
It really would. Proponents of changing the law often point to birth tourism as a reason we need this shift. They cite a Center for Immigration Studies estimate of 33,000 annual births to tourists traveling here just for a passport.
But didn't the Niskanen Center find a massive mathematical error in that data?
Yes, a 90% error, actually.
Wait, 90%? That's huge.
Exactly. The initial estimate mistakenly counted nearly all births to foreign-born mothers as tourists. But 90% of those mothers had actually been living in the U.S. for years. The true number of birth tourists is roughly 2,000 annually.
That drastically changes the scale of the problem, especially when you consider that eliminating automatic birthright citizenship means the government has to verify the parentage of 4 million U.S. births every single year.
It would be a monumental administrative burden.
Imagine an agonizing, expensive DMV visit for every new parent just to get a Social Security number. The report notes this could add up to 73 million hours of paperwork annually.
What's fascinating here is the broader economic implications, too. The report highlights Ireland. From 1999 to 2004, they maintained birthright citizenship before eventually revoking it.
And what does the data show?
Studies show that during their birthright era, they actually attracted a much higher share of highly educated migrants.
Oh, interesting. Because skilled professionals want secure status for their kids.
Exactly. They are far more likely to invest their talents in a country if their children's status is unquestioned, which ties directly into the U.S. data. Second-generation immigrants are our strongest tax-paying demographic.
Right. They're the ones providing the vital tax base for an aging population. But legally altering this is basically impossible, isn't it?
Yeah, because of the 1898 Wong Kim Ark Supreme Court decision, changing this requires a nearly impossible constitutional amendment, not just an executive order.
So this isn't just an abstract political argument. It's about the fundamental definition of American membership and how easily you can prove your own status without a massive paperwork nightmare. If the U.S. ever did adopt a European-style jus sanguinis as a rite of blood system, how many generations back would you personally have to search to definitively prove your own right to belong?